now in the open session of Columbia City Council on the 5th of August, 2024. And this is a continuation from our budget work session last Monday with any questions that came out. And I don't know if there's any updates that staff wants to provide. Matt, I'm going to kick it to you in the heart.
So I think that ideally what we'd like to do is start off with the questions that we had from the last work session. And then there's some questions that came in through email, and then we'll start talking about those questions. And then if there's any additional questions, we can kind of add that on to the list of questions that we have.
Yeah.
So I think the first thought is let's talk about the questions that were submitted during the work session. I think Matt has a list of questions. Some of those we have responses to. Some of those we'll have to ask for some clarifying comments to get additional information.
And as just a quick reminder for those, since we're all in the same room, if you want to, you can watch the recording from the work session. I believe it was recorded for the work session, those who missed it. Tonight we'll do, it's basically the first public hearing, but we will not be voting on the budget tonight, but we'll be taking public comment.
All right, so the first question that we have filled was, why was there a difference between CDBG revenue and expenses? And normally, those should be, the revenues and expenses should match each other. I think this was just a forecasted number. And so that's probably why I think if we wanted to put them both in line, the expenses and the revenue, we could do that. That'd be fine as well. So that was just forecasted number based on previous years.
And it was nothing to do with the unspent funds that then returned?
Because I don't think that was the case, but I'm not exactly sure.
Since we thought this was going to actually start at 5:45, I think Becky from the Housing Department will be here, so if you can ask that clarifying question when she gets in.
Okay.
But from what we could tell when we looked at it, it looked like it was just a forecasted amount.
When you say forecasted, can you say more about what that means, though?
So looking at previous years and then forecasting that number forward.
But we'd still be looking at that number coming in and going out, right?
So, yes, but, I mean, the numbers could change. So they're expecting around $1 million for a home, a million for CDBG, and about $470,000 for a home this year, and that is for estimated full entitlement amounts for both CDBG and home.
Right.
And so that the additional amount was just what that forecasted amount looked like over time.
Do you have like a slide that you're going off of, or is this just other?
No, this was just a question. I believe, but it was, I believe, in the slide.
It is.
It's somewhere in here. Okay.
Yeah. Let me get to
it. It's in your presentation, was it not? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. Budget work session.
Where can we best put our hands on that?
An email from Christina Wolf.
Well, I might be able to pull it up.
Oh, he needs to bring up the slides first.
Oh, I forgot I can do this. Brian won't yell at me. Said it was 31.
Yeah,
so what should have been around 1.5 is 1.9.
So that should have been around 1.5. I couldn't
1.5.
Thank you, sir.
Around that number.
Oh, I see.
For
so
the entitlement number.
So the
2 seconds ago.
CDBG, is that inclusive of home then?
Yes.
Okay. So that's CDBG and home, and actually what, should be is around 1.5, and then the expenses?
I'm not sure why the expenses
okay.
Are less, but I think...
That was really my question, the amount in the revenue side, in either case, it's like, why wouldn't we spend all the money that we have?
That's true. I definitely understand that.
Okay.
So are we good or want some further?
Well, okay. If we just get a little clarity about that from Becky, maybe.
Becky.
they're wondering why the, even though we said $1 million for CDBG and 400 for home, so that would still make the expenses around 400,000 less. Is there a reason why there was less expenses? Because I don't know that answer.
But I think that, I know that that was similar to what we had estimated as our expenses for fiscal year 2024. I think part of that is the difference in our fiscal year and then the program year for the CDBG and home funding and why that kind of gets a little bit off there.
They're July 1?
They're program year January.
Okay.
Okay. That makes sense.
So yeah. we're looking at total expenditure of CDBG and home funds. It's just in terms of the year.
Right. Okay.
It comes in one year. It doesn't all necessarily get spent the same year.
Gotcha. Okay. So the second question, social services funding over time. So we have included that in the presentation that
for tonight.
But I mean, I guess if you want to see it now, I could show it to you now.
We can come back to it.
Okay.
If you're going to show it, you don't show it to me twice in one night.
cost for additional Route B routes through Parish Road. I believe we did have a estimate for that. I didn't have that.
Yeah. So, have they seen anything that
no.
Put together? Okay. So I put together an email to send it to the Carlin that talks about current staffing. And so right now where we sit, when you look at, we've got 31 active drivers. We've got 4 in the onboarding or training process. So in theory, that gets us to within 2 of being fully staffed. However, we currently have 6 drivers that are out for FMLA. That's pretty standard, somewhere around that number. So we have 24 available drivers today, which is about where we were when we combined routes. So we're kind of status quo as far as that's concerned. We currently have 4 hours of mandatory overtime, and that number will go up when MU routes start back up again. So as far as a budgetary help, the biggest thing we can do is consider authority to add more drivers. The reason I didn't ask at the beginning of the budget season is I was so short of my full allotment. I didn't think it was right to ask for drivers when I was still 6-7 short. I'm getting closer there. So 4 drivers or so would be awesome as far as that's concerned. As far as a Route B route is concerned, our consultant tells us it's, I'll make sure I get the numbers right, because I'll screw it up. It's like $350,000. And that's based on a good estimate is $100 per service hour per bus to operate. So when you look at running 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then 8 hours on Saturday, that gets us to $350,000. So that's how much a budgetary impact a route out to Route B would be. The concern that I have is until we're staffed at a level that we can uncombine routes, I would prefer to do that before we start talking about Route B.
What's the budgetary impact of giving the authority to hire 4 new?
That I don't know without.
Because that would be then the potential budget adjustment that council might request.
Yeah, so it would end up if you need another bus?
We wouldn't need another actual bus, but if far as Route B is concerned, you need another couple folks in order to do that.
Well, I was thinking it's two different things. One is a budget amendment for the authority to hire 4 new drivers, which hopefully would get us to an uncombined routes status. And then the second is the Route B, which is one of the expectations we expect from our transit study right now.
Yes.
And would that 350 go with those additional 2 drivers? Or like, would that cover those additional
the
2 drivers?
The cost of that includes the drivers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But not the additional ones?
No, that $350,000 is just for Route B.
As if we already have those drivers for
yes.
it.
Yes. Yes.
And so if you want a dollar amount for 4 additional drivers, plus Route B, we can do that in 2 separate.
I had to say
2 separate. Yes.
Yeah.
We can bring that in 2 separate.
Yeah. And then, but would you have to add the 2?
You'd have to have the 4
the additional. Right. I'm just thinking for the total, it would be more than 350 because it'd also be the cost for 2 additional drivers for the authority. Because you don't have them in your bench.
The $350,000 was basically an off-the-cuff fuel, bus, maintenance, drivers,
salary,
all that.
But so not that, capacity of actual drivers to drive the bus.
Correct. You would need 2 drivers on the Route B route.
Right. Betsy.
It sounds like we're still having trouble hiring drivers. Do we know why?
It's a nationwide thing. We're getting applicants to we're even hiring, whether they make it all the way through to actually driving a bus or driving a bus and deciding that they like to drive a bus is more the issue. We're seeing applicants. We're seeing people drop out on their way to being a full-time bus driver.
Do we know why? Are the buses too big? Is it the mandatory overtime? Is it the...
It's a whole combination of things. It kind of varies. Some people have trouble with the size of the bus. Some people have trouble with the personal interaction on paratransit. That's another thing. Our paratransit rides are averaging about 270 people a day. So about 10 paratransit.
270 people a day?
Mm-hmm.
So when we provide service, I have to provide that service first. So there's 10 drivers right there to paratransit off that 31 number.
Okay.
And so that cuts down the number of people I have for fixed route. So the combined route, instead of having 6 buses driving, I only have 3 because each bus is doing 2 routes. So that dramatically cuts down the number of people I need on fixed route, mainly for pushing paratransit.
Okay.
But it varies. Some people just like it, I'll be honest. Pay at the end, I think there's other jobs you can do and don't have that. There's some of the things that come with driving a bus all day.
Mm-hmm.
But it varies. But I will caution you and say that you can look at about any city our size or bigger.
Okay.
Similar issues.
So, I mean, I know we just adjusted how much we pay them, but I didn't know whether that was a pay thing or just a job. You know, it's a job thing no matter what they pay.
She asked.
Okay.
Change in pay has led us to have interviews, and we've been able to hire better. We're within 2 of being fully staffed to this day. Usually it's that process of onboarding and training them where we really lose
them.
We've had some people let go that, you know, for
whatever reason.
You asked what Shane did, what the budgetary cost for a bus driver would be. It's approximately $67,000. That's benefits. That's what we stick into the computer for total compensation package.
Thank you. And I know I'm supposed to magically come up with where that revenue would come from, too, when making that suggestion. So if there's a suggestion, please let me know. Roy, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay.
I do have a question about, is it $7,000 that we need to put into the transportation system?
$700,000.
Or is it more than that to keep it this free? Sorry.
$700,000,
sorry. Where is that coming from?
Transportation sales tax.
And so normally that transportation sales tax, how is that normally split up?
So it's split up between 3 different groups. It's split up between streets and sidewalks. It's transit and airport.
So is this coming from the airport or the streets, or this is just what normally would come from the transportation sales tax?
It is what normally would come. Like, so there's, it's not really, we don't have, it's just a bucket, and we allocate what we can to each one of those. We were able to add that additional amount. I think this slide here, though, 32, shows our transportation sales tax expected revenues and our expected expenses. So we got a little bit of wiggle room there. As far as revenues over expenses, but that's kind of, if we get up to that, close to that $19 million amount,
okay,
we could go excess over our revenues.
Because I thought at one point in time, like the transportation sales tax, like 50% of that was for streets, 25% was for buses, and 25% for the airport. I might be wrong on those. That was years ago, so I don't know what we're doing now.
Yeah, I think it kind of changes yearly.
I'm sorry?
Where the needs
depending
are.
On the needs.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not fixed.
No, it's not fixed.
And remember, because of some of the upgrades we made to the airport, our cost for the airport has increased. And so that cost for bus service has increased. And so it's all looking at the need. And so your priorities are your airport, your rolling transit, and then streets and sidewalks. So that's how things kind of lined up.
But for a while we had extra money, like ARPA money, for the airport?
Yeah.
And we had some for transit as well that went to specifically for the bus route. So we just lost that funding this year, I believe. 24 was the end of that funding.
Yeah. We were able to build up a bit of a surplus in this during COVID due to the CARES money and ARPA money, but
right.
That's ended now, and we're back. You know, we have a surplus in our reserves, but if we're going to do ongoing expenses, we don't really want to match those to, you want to match your ongoing expenses to your ongoing revenues.
I thought we were looking at making the airport a little bit more self-sufficient. Is that any chance that's going to happen?
Never to tell.
I hear really quiet. I hear nothing, actually.
Crickets.
Don has a question.
I was looking, it doesn't go back far enough. What were we bringing in revenue-wise back in what is now seemingly the Stone Age when we charged for transit?
I want to say about
much.
$2 million. What, it wasn't that
one or two bus drivers?
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah,
not
I don't
that.
Think.
Okay.
I can look into that and get you those numbers. I wouldn't want to say anything off the top of my head, though. It wasn't a significant amount of money.
Because we didn't charge much.
$100,000,
maybe. Yeah.
Was it that low? So,
it
like,
was
what was
to
that, 2020? 19. Okay. For some reason, I thought it was
more. It was pre-COVID.
Thank you.
If I recall correctly, over many transportation discussions over the decades, that it's my understanding that in general, the bus system is always going to need to be subsidized at some level. I think the spirit of concern is if it's just free, the value there of that, and also the ridership, and then if when you take some sample rides, which I'm sure many people in here do. You'll notice that there's one group of people who are not often on the buses, and it's women and children. It's just the reality. So I think that, we have to think about that value of we pay a little for something, and then, that means that it matters a little bit more. When it's just free, and plus nothing's free. I think that's the four-letter F word, that the other one that I don't like too much because it's an untrue statement. It's always, the reality is that it's subsidized at some level, and when usually people have put a little bit into something, they tend to value it more.
Okay. Did you have, I got that number now.
Oh, okay.
So in 19, we brought in between paratransit and regular bus fares $281,000.
Way out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, Shane.
What does it cost us?
One thing I'd remind everybody of is when you don't charge, you can't charge for paratransit.
Right.
Unless you, if you don't charge for fixed route, meaning, and you can charge a little bit more for paratransit, so you lose both of those revenue streams. So that's just a fact. No.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to push in any direction.
Thank you.
All right, so the next question we had is still transit related, and it was the addition of the bus ambassadors.
Yeah, so this was a question I asked.
Yeah.
So for those who weren't listening to me, I was asking, you know, one of the comments that we had was about if the driver can focus on driving. You know, sometimes like on school buses, there's a bus monitor that can help answer questions for riders, as well as kind of provide that where you're going, where you're doing next, and provide a little bit of like, so the driver can focus on driving, helping out with the, and I was asking, do any cities do like a monitor program or an ambassador program where people could ride along to and kind of provide that additional body to maybe make a mother and child, you know, feel comfortable because they can get their questions answered or also just be there. And I don't know if we looked into that.
Yes.
If I made this up.
We know that the cost for, and we have not like submitted it to HR to have them code and officially look at a job description and rank and, you know, rate how they do for an appropriate job classification level. But in talking through what we felt were your goals and aims on it, we felt like it might fall into an area with the CSAs that work with the police department that go on site occasionally. And the budgeted price for those would be approximately $58,000 to $60,000 per position.
And my assumption would be if it were to be a successful, actual, robust program, it would be something where it'd be like per bus. So the same as driver to monitor would be the same ratio. So
31 times
37 is fully staffed for your bus drivers.
Yeah, I don't think you would utilize this for paratransit.
Okay.
So you'd just use it for
fixed
routes.
Oh, okay.
So there's six routes, and there's 68 hours per week. Six full time, maybe six part time, because you need, you know, to make up that total amount. Plus, they're not driving, so there's another thing you have to remember that by rule, a driver can only drive so long.
Right.
So a monitor can sit on the bus
for 8 hours.
3 hours a day.
Okay. Probably wouldn't want to, but yeah. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Is this position you're thinking? To control the unruly people on the bus? Or?
It could be both, you know, because we've heard before from drivers sometimes that sometimes they don't feel as comfortable on certain routes, certain times. So it'd be potentially providing that. But also for me, I was thinking more of the ambassador. And the conversation was from talking to the STA monitors and about how like they build relationships with the students riding, you know, and so like building that ambassador for people feeling comfortable, maybe more routine riding of the bus, because you get to see Lisa, and you're the monitor. I've just named you a monitor. Actually, you cannot work for the city, so you can't have this job. But you know, like that sort of. And it was just an idea of trying to think about to get more people riding the bus.
And so next was the yeah, the question about. Cities our size having health care that doesn't have cost to employees, and we do have some answers for that, but I think regarding the HSA, that is our only plan. That plan basically bankrolls our health plan, so I wouldn't advise getting rid of that plan.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just talking about, like, so you have a health insurance plan,
and then I know we're self-insured, and it's really tough to negotiate because you've got like two choices: United Healthcare and Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's it. End of story. And so, I'm very cognizant of the challenges that are in healthcare. Period. End of story. Worked in it, dealt with plans and such. So my question was for the individual employees to have it fully, you know, each year it's going to go, it's gone up just in the last couple of years, it's just going to keep going up. So the city absorbs the cost for that. And so my question is about, you know, is that unusual for other cities, or are they asking for, you know, the individual, like if I worked here and I carried the insurance and then I also had my spouse and, you know, others on that, if I'm paying for myself in addition to those, a percentage, a small portion.
Yeah, so that was something that we determined as when we start looking at some of the impact that we've had for pay. We made the determination for at least the last couple of years that we would absorb that cost for the additional increase as opposed to passing it on to the employees. Normally what we would do, if we got that increase, we would share it with the employees. So the cities would pay their percentage and the employee would pay their percentage. But because of our pay issues, we decided that we would cover that cost because we did have the capacity under our self-insured fund.
Yeah, and it's very generous, and I'm not saying that that's a bad thing to do. It's not sustainable.
And this was, we will definitely look at it again next year, but right now we have the balance to, there's a balance in that fund to help us cover these costs. And so it's not really something. Go ahead.
So you asked us to collect some data. So
yeah.
We did that, what we could in the short amount of time we did. So I had staff do some local organizations, and then our benefits consultant, I had to look at their book of business for public sector clients so I could get some data. So I've broken that down by local organizations. 3 out of 9 offer a high deductible health plan at no cost to the employee. Interesting, those 3 are the state of Missouri, Boone County, and Columbia Public Schools. So they're all public sector that do that. From our benefit consultants book of business, 21 out of 29 charge zero for the high deductible health plan. So it seems like it's very common in the public sector. The other thing we looked at is the annual health savings account contributions and how we compare to them as well. So the city contributes $1,500 a year for employee only, and that's paid out by paycheck. So if you stop working in the middle of the year, you don't get the full thing.
Right.
Some employers don't do that. They load it up front, but we do it by pay period. So we do $1,500 for employee only and $3,000 a year for family. And family is employee plus one or however many. So that's our contribution. The average contribution for local employers is $565.25 a year for employee only, $1,159 for family. So we're higher than both of those. With our benefit consultants book of business, which is all public sector, the average for employee only was $1,075 and some change, and for family was $1,200 and some change. So we're in the market when you look at public sector HSA contributions. We do have 3 plans. We have a 750 PPO plan, which is a closed plan. No new enrollments can go into it, but those that are in it can stay in it. And but once they leave, they can't go back. And so we really have for new hires the choice of the $1,500 deductible PPO plan or the high deductible health plan, which we do the contribution. Employees do pay for a portion of $1,500 PPO plan. They pay nothing for the high deductible for employee only. If you look at our loss ratio, and I don't want to get too deep in this, but I want to make sure that you get the information that you're looking for. So loss ratio is the ratio of the sum of incurred claims to the sum of health premiums. So right now, like in 2023, and this is active employees only, so this doesn't count retirees or those that are on COBRA. But in 2023, our high deductible health plan had a loss ratio of 78.4%. Our 1500 had 106.7%, and our 750 at 151.5%. And so our high deductible health plan is really covering the cost of what I consider the more, you know, expensive plans. They're really not taking in enough premiums for those PPO plans to cover those, but we are on the high deductible, so that's helping us stay solvent in that. So there is a pretty significant difference in the loss ratio. Does that help with, is there more information that
I think that's helpful. That when I hear that it's unsustainable, that causes me a bit of concern, because benefits are something that are so attractive for an organization, which makes me ask the other questions that I sent by email, because I'd like to see us get on a sustainable plan instead of having the anxiety of like, oh my goodness, what's going to change? I mean, I've worked in organizations where you know that there's going to be a change taking place, and the anxiety that creates.
But to clarify, this has not been the consistent. Like, as the costs have increased, the city has historically shared that cost addition to the employees. I think it's just because they had the overage in this one that they were able to absorb it. But it doesn't sound like it's your policy going forward.
No.
Right.
2023.
Right.
It was 3.5% both by the employee and the employer, so we both increased our contributions by 3.5%. We didn't do an increase in 22. In 21, it was a shared 5.6% each. So it typically has been a shared expense. But again, DeCarlene has been trying to move the needle on wages, and because we have a healthy reserve fund now,
we're able to use it for this.
We're able to do that. I will say that we have some very high claims this year that we're going to have to really keep an eye on how that plays out. So, because our premiums are based on really two main factors, which is your claims experience and medical inflation. Those are the two things that drive the premiums.
So really, we're able to do this year. Mm-hmm. Conditions will likely change. And we'll look at it on an annual basis in anticipation of changes.
And we do an annual claims review every year. We're reviewing it with our provider, and do we need to do plan design change? What do we need to do to adjust based on what's going on? So it's a continuous conversation. We get reports all throughout the year, and you do an annual review as well. And the city manager, when he did his meeting with all employees about the draft budget, he prepared them that next year we're probably going to have to split the cost again. So we've been saying that. I don't know how well they hear it, but we'll keep repeating that as well, so that there's not a big surprise.
Yeah.
We need to do that next
year. Good.
Melanie, then I'd like for us to see what we could do to be able to get ourselves maybe in a position where we could keep that as a benefit to differentiate ourselves. If we look at some of the other things that I've asked about.
So the next one,
number 7,
the council NDI for $5,000. So this is travel and training requested by the Airport Advisory Board to assist with acquiring air service. This will cover travel expenses for flight, hotel mileage, etc.
Now I understand, and I apologize for not being here at the work session, but I understand that the council had some questions on the procedural aspect in which the boards and commissions would ask for new funding. And so I just wanted to, hear how you all would like that done in the future, or if you wanted to table it and think about it, just remembering that it would have to be done in an open meeting.
So Sheila was able to send us some of the historic emails that go out to department heads, which say, if your board or commission has a request, this is what they've done in the past. So I think I'd look to kind of that recommendation with what would be the process, also fitting within your timeline. I think for some, they come to council and they make that request to us, and so we get to see that and say, yes, DeCarlin, this seems to align. The ones that we don't see, sometimes it seems like it seems weird to put it under the council budget since we didn't say to do. So I think potentially aligning it for when you talk to council priorities in early in the year, in January, February, if maybe sometime around that same time, boards and commissions are asked if they're going to be having an additional request or reviewing past what, something like that, just so, you know, it does become, it's not a surprise to us.
Yeah. I think, for me, it's this falls under council, so I feel a certain responsibility for it, and it's just about meeting that responsibility. This isn't about a distrust of the process as it has been.
Yeah, we can push the date back so that boards and commissions would have theirs more, maybe perhaps more in mind with when we do have that first strategic budget priority meeting.
Yeah.
At least have maybe some initial
discussions.
And then the last from the actual work session was the affordable versus attainable housing. And what was the thoughts on that? And so we had defined what affordable housing is.
Becky gave us information on what constituted affordable housing per the HUD guidelines. And so she sent us the information kind of with an example scenario with those to kind of help understand how affordable housing is defined. But certainly...
I think there's probably two caveats. The one caveat is how do you define affordable housing? So that's what we looked at, is 30% of gross income for those who are occupying that home. The second part is when we look at the trust fund that we're talking about, who is it trying to assist? And I think that's where we look at the 80% of the average median income for Columbia, and then that kind of talks about what that looks like. And so that, I think that becomes part of the question. I think the thought was if we can just change it from affordable to attainable.
And net.
Right.
Not gross.
Well, so we're going with HUD standards, and that's how we say gross income. Those are the HUD standards, and it's easy to follow none of those guidelines when you say we're following the actual federal guideline for what that definition is. And so that's the reason we're going with gross. And I
realize that you have to deal with that with grants and such. I'm getting that. But I mean, when we use the term, I think that it's too confusing if we say, you know, this is for, quote, affordable housing. And I'm mindful of the fact that the federal government has their own definition. But I would encourage us to get rid of the word affordable, say it attainable, and change it from gross income to net income. Because that's real dollars and cents that people, because gross is pre-tax. That's not what's going to be in their check every month.
So I guess my question is, are you suggesting to come up with a definition of attainable housing that we're using that incorporates net income into that definition?
I would keep it real simple. It's one sentence that, attainable housing is housing for which occupants are paying no more than 30% of their net income for housing costs.
Well, I would oppose that. I mean, I feel like we need to be in line with what the federal government's definition. This is one that the community is aware of. People who are providing housing services aligned with this, and it's understood, at least in the community of those who are in. And part of what we've struggled with, I think, is a definition for affordable housing, but. A while back when we went back and looked at this, we saw that the Fair Housing Task Force had made that determination and the city council approved that, and that this was the definition. So, I mean, everyone deals with that issue of net versus gross, but in terms of just programs and so forth, I would prefer we just stay in line with where we have been.
So when we say affordable housing, we're only talking about people that fit into the HUD perspective? Or are we going to say that affordable housing could mean affordable for first-time homebuyers?
No. No, I think that, you know, the question of affordable, a lot of people think of affordable as being, they think of it only for folks who are of low income or low income households. But the reality is that affordability is in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of the household. And so there are some people who are able to afford a $500,000 house, and there are some who are able to afford something higher than that. Whether or not they conform to the 30% of their expenses, some people extend beyond what they're able to do. But part of the reason that we follow this is because that seems, it, I think we're using attainable in a different way, but if somebody is able to get into housing in which they spend no more than 30%, then that becomes manageable. And it's just been a norm. And it's a national norm.
Does the discussion around this, by having this definition, by us aligning with the federal standards, does it potentially open us up to additional match opportunities?
So I think it's two caveats. So for the definition itself, it's that is the definition. When we talk about the trust fund trying to incentivize or trying to come up with processes in order to assist with getting people up to that level, it is looking at the 80% of the AMI, and that would help with grants or matching funds that may come up from maybe some type of grant that we may find. And so it's just aligning those processes. And so I think when you ask the question, I think it's twofold. It's looking at what the true definition of affordability is, because affordability is different to different people. But then when you look at the trust fund, the people that we're trying to assist with that fund, it's the people that meet that AMI, that average median income, or 80% of the average median income. And then I think we put out like the dollar amount for me, so like the one person, $57,000.
So to your point, Lisa, you know, I think when you talk about attainability, I think you're also referring to the other aspects that go into home construction, like how to access it. Am I correct? Like based on some of the conversations you had? Mm-hmm. So it might just be like the yes and. Like, yes, affordable housing is defined in how HUD defines it, and we consistently do with that. And then we also explore other ways to make more housing opportunities available mm-hmm. and attainable mm-hmm. to more community members. Mm-hmm. And that's through evaluating other aspects, like looking at our fees and permitting, how we do right. zoning, those sort of things.
Well, I do think it comes down to the definition.
Yeah, and I think defining it as consistent with HUD makes sense to me.
Right.
But then also the acknowledgement that also to attain housing, mm-hmm. there are other factors in play, availability of it. You know, those sort of things that maybe we can also be focusing on to encourage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a serious inventory mm-hmm. issue. I mean,
that is the issue.
It
and
is.
When we
yeah.
were talking about a housing trust fund, the central to that, in my understanding, is to address that issue so that we can incentivize construction.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've mentioned addressing issues related to the UDC and fees and so forth that are required. And that's part of the housing study that's going on now. And I anticipate I think it's both and. I
yeah.
think we need to be looking at those things that are within our code that are limiting our opportunities and limiting the opportunities for developers in the community to build what we need to have built. But I think that's likely also going to be enhanced by the Housing Trust Fund, which will go hand in hand with those other things. So I think there's a dual track here for addressing this
yeah.
from both perspectives.
How quickly will we assess if this is working or not so we can correct our course if it's not? So, you know, if we just have money sitting there, we're not meeting the needs of people. You know, so many of these grants have so many strings attached. They have so many limitations.
And that's the reason why we're not just relying. That's the reason why it's not.
They're never easy.
Right, and that's the reason why we're not relying just on grants.
Like this is our own grants going out.
And that's part of the reason why we thought about creating a trust fund is because we know that we're going to have to be part of that process of trying to incentivize or trying to create processes that will help people get there. And so it's setting up those programs that will help assist people. So one of the things that we know is if we can, right now we're looking at property that the city owns
that potentially could be utilized for development of new housing or infill housing. And so then it's creating a process where we can actually create a process where we can allow for, you know, developers to bid on that property in order to go through that track. But understanding that part of that process is if we're going to utilize that land, we have to make sure that it's being built is important. And so those are one of the programs that we're really trying to do. And so it's looking at what we can, how can we leverage those funds to actually increase our housing stock that will allow us to allow more people to get into that level of affordability.
And do we have this just written somewhere, just a couple of general bullet points on how this is going to be administered?
Well, so we're wrapping up the tail end of the housing study. From that housing study, there's going to be some recommendations that are going to come out from that consultant. But we have a housing summit that's scheduled for October 24th, where we kind of bring the community together and say, here's what we heard. Here's what it looks like. Here's some of the things that we need to work on. And then we can develop a plan on how do we address those things that come out of that study. And so that's our goal in order to move things forward.
And then I also say, you know, any programs that we develop that will be using the trust fund will come before the council to approve. So as we can get that housing study back in terms of develop those programs, we'll bring them back to council to have those discussions as to whether or not that's an appropriate way to expend the housing trust fund revenues.
All right. Thank you.
Now I think you want to address some of the questions from the...
Yeah, so we had some questions that came in online that were emailed to us. And so we just want to kind of talk about getting a response to some of those questions. I think probably the one that we can start with is the one that was asked about the recycling.
Oh, okay.
And so I think the request. So we have 5 years of recycling revenue, and we have what are some of the things that are accepted for recycling, and what can be recycled out. I think the one thing that we probably need to really, and so there's some additional information we need to provide, because I think the one thing that we have to really understand is recycling does not pay for itself. It is subsidized by our solid waste effort from just normal fees. But the benefit of recycling is that it extends the life of our landfill. The more tons that you can divert from the landfill, the longer your life in your landfill. And you know, it's when you look at the state of Missouri, you look at landfill utilization, you want to preserve the life of your landfill as long as possible. And so that's part of the reason why we recycle. And so we can provide you some of that information that kind of give you some of that background information. But I want to say up front, recycling doesn't pay for itself. But it does extend the life of our landfill, which is invaluable to our processes.
Because we don't necessarily monitor the avoided cost.
Exactly.
Of what it would be.
Yes.
Right.
And that's a more larger analysis, because you have to look at, you know, what's the size of the landfill, what does that mean for square footage?
Yeah. Did you have some numbers, or are you guys still pulling? Okay.
We didn't actually get the spreadsheet.
I only got part of it,
apparently. It was just the email that was forwarded, not the spreadsheets.
Which numbers are we talking about here?
For recycling.
What we actually are recycling, what the income is from that, and so forth.
Can we get that?
That's what
information
he's. That's what they're sending right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought they didn't have it all.
He has it. Okay. He just emailed.
Okay.
But I do have a question.
Yes, sir.
Why was that not included anywhere in the budget as far as revenues or
funds? Well, because it's not segmented out.
It's in solid waste.
So where is
it? Part of our,
yeah, but where is it?
It is just part of the overall solid waste revenue. So it's not segmented out between recycling and other key points. Now, that's how it's been. If that's something we want to kind of change, we can.
Yeah, because in looking through the line items as far as revenue, I didn't see anything. So you're saying it would be like fees covered with, not fee. Let me find the darn chart.
Dave, can you talk about exactly how
fees and service charges?
fees and service charges. I disagree with that classification, frankly. But okay, good. So I know where it is at least.
That's also where utility rates though come through.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just adding the letter, because that's also where your utility rates come through in that line item, which I assume is the GFOA standard for how you track those revenues.
So each revenue has a breakdown or a roll up into it, and so I guess you could potentially have additional codes under that fees and services that will roll up into it, but that's not something we've done with our current software. Did you send it to Andrea as well?
No, I sent it to you.
No, sorry. It needs to come to me, please. I'm the one that has the pulled up, so.
Yeah, I'm with this one.
We're tag teaming it on about three systems over here.
And we will also continue to be having budget conversation in our regular meeting at 7 o'clock. So
yes.
Once we get closer to 6:50, I will stop us.
Yes, ma'am.
I could pull it up.
Oh, but I'm this far into it, so we'll just... Okay, so... This is residential recycling. Oh, you're going to put it up on the screen?
Yeah.
Don,
okay.
What page of the budget are you looking at?
The printed copy is 255. I think the online is going to be different.
Okay, probably.
Probably.
So, yeah, I would just do a search for solid waste and go to that section.
Okay, so is there, I guess these are the recycling revenues by materials. Was there, did you want me to go through each specific breakdown of them, or were there certain ones?
Briefly, if you can. I mean, they're also a total, but I mean,
okay.
Yeah,
so
if you can.
Year to date for FY24, we are at $852,000.
Still don't see it.
He's trying to get it up.
Okay.
Yeah, he's trying. No.
And this is revenue from what we sell for recycling?
It should be down. Scroll down.
Should be attached to what I sent you, Andrew.
Let me just forward it to you real quick. Because I think okay, see if you get it now.
Well, it's on hers. It's not on mine for some reason.
I just got something I got the same thing from Dave just now. So I just forwarded it to you.
Yeah, it's taking forever.
Sorry,
technical difficulty.
Hopefully it will.
It's not coming through.
Yeah, it's.
Can we just unplug?
Yeah, just here. This is yours. Put this off. And now it came through.
Now it's through, of course. All right, let's download it.
The other one is probably the one you want to show.
There it is.
Nope.
Is this the wrong one, Dave?
No, I would show the other one first.
Okay. This one?
Yeah, let's make it a little bigger, please. I can't see it.
Yeah, well, these things happen.
Right.
It's a magnifying glass.
You know, which pair of glasses?
So what we did here when that request came in this morning was we got our actuals. Revenues and expenses from residential recycling, commercial recycling, and operations of the MRF for 2021, or 21, 22, 23, and 24 year to date. And as DeCarlin said, recycling has got to be subsidized. A couple things we'll point out here is if you look at fiscal year 2024 to date, the residential recycling, the revenues, the only revenue we charge for residential recycling is if somebody calls and says, I have a refrigerator or I have a stove or something that I want you to pick up, and then we charge. That's the only revenue that shows up in that line is that $11,000. But we spend $1 million collecting recycling from residential. Even if we don't do recycling, we're still going to spend that $1 million picking that material up and transporting it to the landfill. It doesn't matter whether it goes to the Murfer landfill. The collection cost still is going to be there.
Because you do it by weight, correct?
Well, it's a matter of it's got to go into a truck and be driven across town.
Right.
So it's
right.
going to take the same number of trucks, same number of people, whether it's going to the MRF or going to the landfill.
Gotcha.
Same on commercial recycling. So those losses on those two, if you want to call it loss, which it is, we're still going to have that basically $2 million expense for collections no matter what.
Okay.
So the big important line, in my opinion, for recycling is revenues for the MRF versus expenses for the MRF. And so year-to-date, we're about $400,000 short, and it probably would be fairly straightforward to show that the savings of space in the landfill offsets that $400,000.
Okay.
I haven't done that math,
yeah.
But I bet we would. And if you go back to 22,
you made money.
We actually sold more recycling
mm-hmm.
than what it cost us to run the MRF.
Mm-hmm.
So I think recycling is a good program to have because it does help with our landfill space.
I'm not questioning that
okay.
at all. But, you know, we talk about, you know, the note is in the budget
yeah.
that the 3 through 7 plastics, a couple of years ago, we could sell, the market's fallen off. A new MRF would help solve that because then we can sort it into the individuals. And again, we're going to be talking about it. We're going to have to propose and take it to the community about building, you know, what do we do with the MRF, all right? And if we can say, okay, we're getting something out of it, it would just be
so the 3 through 7
beneficial.
So what I've done here is we've busted it up by all our different categories.
Okay.
And it's FY24 year to date, and down through 20. If you look at 3 through 7, so you can see like in 20 we weren't able to sell any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody had bought it all. And then in 22 we were able to get rid of all of it. But if we actually broke those up into 3, 4, 5, you know, we would have an easier time finding a market for it.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't significantly increase our revenue, but we wouldn't have it stockpiled out there on site.
Right, yeah. Right. And then deciding, well, you know, what to do with it, or do we, you know, actually put it in the landfill, and then we lose that benefit that you're talking about. So.
And you can see okay. that the market is very volatile.
Yeah.
Because, you know, look at the very first column's cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
2020, $400,000. 22, almost $1 million.
Yeah.
And we're back down to $460,000 year to date. So it's a very volatile market.
Yeah, Nick.
On the revenue for the MRF, is that all from sales of materials, or do we charge other municipalities for bringing things to
basically
our MRF?
Basically, all sales of materials. What is not reflected on this sheet? That we don't have tracked in the data where we got this, is it doesn't, the other revenue includes the sale of appliances as scrap.
Mm.
So the other revenues are a little bit higher than these, and then there was a couple things that Sarah and I saw that were recorded as revenue that were recorded in the wrong location. We sold a trailer, and it got recorded as scrap when it should have been auction
okay.
revenue. But we can fix that.
Do we have other municipalities? Do we serve other municipalities at all? No.
Generally, no.
Is that a potential revenue source with the construction of a new MRF?
We allow people to bring stuff.
To bring stuff to the landfill.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we don't go out and pick up anybody's house.
Well, no, that's not what I meant. I just wondered if anybody else brought theirs to us.
There's nobody else bringing recycling to us now currently.
Yeah,
the county. Boone County does, okay, I forgot about that.
I say through them in Missouri Solid Waste, right? Because we have the containers in the county.
No, county.
Yeah.
But yeah, the county does that themselves now.
Yeah.
Oh, but like Centralia, I think what he's saying is like Centralia doesn't bring theirs to us to sell.
Through the county's program, they collect recycling in Centralia. They bring that material to us, but if it's contaminated, I believe they end up having to pay the full landfill fee. So that reduces some of what they bring us.
to answer some of your questions.
It does. So yeah, if you could send me that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah.
You could send it to all of us. That'd be helpful.
That's what we need to do for this budget discussion. We want to make sure that everyone has the same information.
Thank you.
So not knowing, is the next question a longer discussion question? If so, we should save it for the regular meeting. Is there one that has a shorter?
I think the last one is the email that we
So Lisa, we might want to save that one then, because there'll probably be a broader discussion, longer discussion.
We did have a question about the personnel. I think that it was posed to you and it came in a few different ways. We've answered that, but I've also put a slide in the presentation where we'll talk in the regular session about that as well. So.
Okay. Appreciate that. Yeah. Okay. Anything else on this quick things before, and then we'll obviously continue this discussion in that. One of the things that you'll notice on tonight's agenda is that for the last 2 years, we've done both ways, where both we've voted on the fees or any rate increases at this meeting, second read. Though 2 meetings ago, we continued it for the next, so we will have that option as well tonight for the fees and for the utility rates discussion if we want to continue like we did 2 years ago. So I will ask that at the time and ask for council's what way you want to go on that one. I think that's it. All right, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn our work session.